My favorite death sentence is, "No love without threat of absence. A fragment, but nothing's perfect. And nothing is a verb. When we met, you sentenced my other lives to death. I feared nothing more, moored to your smallness. You have my likeness, but there is nothing like you. And despite nothing, you."
Hi, I'm Catherine Rolwagen, Professor of History at Vancouver Island University. Welcome to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities. We introduce you to the people and passions of the Faculty of Arts and Humanities at VIU and share stories about events and projects happening on campus. Our next presentation will be on Friday, February 7th, when Neil Serkin, Professor in the English Department, presents Towards More Uncertainty: Parenting and the Poetics of Hope. I wanted to start just by asking you how you ended up writing poetry.
I was in lots of bands when I was in high school, and I also grew up in a place where spoken word was really popular. And I was obsessed with the optics of the spoken word poem as a young person, but I wasn't sure that it was where I fit really in terms of performance. So I took a modernism course in my first year of university, and suddenly it was like, oh, I'm overwhelmed by the difficulty of these forms. I'm overwhelmed by the scrutiny, I guess, that's being paid to the way that human existence and the way and the fragmented kind of nature of culture kind of are colliding together. And that just got really fascinating to me. So I just kind of started to noodle around and to write. It wasn't really until I started reading Daphne Marlatt's work, who's from Vancouver.
Yes.
And kind of thinking about this like proprioceptive poetics and this kind of the influence of semiotics kind of coming through, that it like just blew open for me. Mm-hmm. But it took a long time to actually fall in love with the form without it being tied to the way I'd kind of grown up around it, which is into the microphone, right, intimate, waiting for snaps, rhythm, maybe there's a band. This is a really different kind of formal approach. And I love it. It's what I think about all the time.
All the time. Well, I think for me, something that has always drawn me to reading poetry is the rhythm and the kind of musicality, for lack of a better word, of it. The way that you can kind of you can almost imagine it to music, or the music is there but it's not there. I don't know. It makes it very like a very intimate experience. I don't know. That's what poetry's always been for me.
Yeah, I'm obsessed with poems that are heavily enjambed. So enjambment being that kind of the line not having a terminal punctuation, so it spills over. Right,
into the next.
Yeah, into the next. This kind of spilling down the page. That was the moment for me where poems kind of started to open up, because you have this incongruency between like melody and form and breath. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the form of the poem can betray the speaker's actual position. They may appear to be lying to you because of the way the poem appears. Those kinds of opportunities just started to really light me up. Mm-hmm. That's like the love for me of it. And it's where I like to teach too. I like to teach on the brinks of the poems, considering the way they spill over.
I've had a chance to look at the chapbook, and I don't know if you pronounce it Die workbook.
Yeah, Die.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was like, is this German?
Yeah, I worry about
reference.
That, actually. That's
no, I
funny.
Think it's fantastic. It's like Die workbook, the workbook. Yeah. But it's also like, it has a very, I had this immediate kind of sympathy where I'm like, yes, sometimes I just want to kill. Sometimes I just want to destroy, or what I'm doing is both so dear to me and also I think it's so terrible that I just want, you know, like anyway, so I love that kind of dual meaning. But then I realized when I read it that it's also the dice, the die, and like casting the die. Is that something about what you were saying about it being?
Oh, that's so funny. I will absolutely betray myself in saying that project is very distinctive from most of the stuff that I do.
All right.
I'm actually as a side note, don't put this in. I'm launching it tomorrow. So oh, okay. I'm really in the middle of thinking about it. Okay. I'm launching it on Zoom. So I'm thinking about the visuals of it. So, but yeah, Die Workbook came out of, I'm really into trail running.
Okay.
It's become one of my Vancouver right. Island identities.
Yes, as it does for here. Many
yeah,
people.
Yeah, I'm really obsessed with it. And last summer during the drought, running in those really brittle, dry woods, I started just kind of thinking about poems where initially I was thinking about like who to blame and how those kind of complicities could maybe be like portrayed in a poem by the way that they fall below the line. So in Die Workbook, there are moments where the words fall below the rest of the poetic line and you can roll a dice to choose the next word that will come. Mm-hmm. So there's this sense of simultaneity, but also the sense of chance both at play. And those kinds of things together kind of helped me relinquish my own agency.
Right, like, yeah.
And also to think about what I'm accountable for and the acts that are going forward. So those are like the interplays of the die, but also, mm-hmm. yes, death reigns supreme in this little manuscript. Mm-hmm. I didn't know. I sent it to Blasted Tree, which is like an experimental press out of Calgary. I really admire Kyle Flemmer. He's the editor there. Okay. And so when I sent it to Kyle, it was just kind of like, oh, if you're interested. And having his affirmation of it has kind of changed the way I think of who I am as a poet, because I mostly am like in tune more with a lyric mode and the tradition of lyric and kind of disrupting that, mm-hmm. which is more about like the mind talking to itself. And we're kind of intimately listening in,
right?
Or maybe one person's being addressed. And this is different. It's a different kind of musicality because it just erupts and it changes on the spot.
Yeah. And it really feels spontaneous, like that chance or that the way that the lines can be in a different order and the verbs can change. And it almost, like my instinct after reading it was to do my own, basically. Mm-hmm. It kind of invites the audience to be like, well, now I want to make one, right? And I love that. It creates a different space that, I mean, some poetry is very much, as someone who is not someone who has studied poetry, sometimes you feel like, I don't know if I'm getting what the poet is intending, right? There's a struggle to kind of reach in to their brain and hear that inner voice that they're trying to communicate. I like it when it's like the door has been opened. It's like, this is my thinking and why don't you try one too? It's really cool.
It's as a small plug to the Blasted Tree. Mm-hmm. It's one of the only things I've published where you can just access the whole thing online.
Yes.
And so I really like that. It has a physical form. The physical form's really beautiful. I'm really proud of how it came out. I had no hand in that part. It's just the production of it was really cool. But the whole manuscript is there online so that people can experiment with this strange little poem that creates itself and disrupts itself. It's one of the only things I can be like, check it out and actually try. Like, get out a dice or use your phone dice or whatever you wish.
The lists are there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I also just want to say, in terms of thinking about the poet's intention, mm-hmm. The poems that I love the best have always like evaded me. Like, I always tell my students deliberately that I will not teach them those poems. Because it's probably just actually a question of my own reading ability, but they are ones that I have never forced into some sense of congruency or understanding mm-hmm. on a deep level for myself. And that's what beckons the return. Like, I come back over and over again because I've been perplexed or because the musicality keeps changing. And so those are my private collection. And there are hundreds, but they're the ones I keep off syllabi and they're the ones I take out of workshops because inevitably someone will be there who will teach me about the poem, and I'm actually not ready to learn.
You came to Vancouver Island. When did you come to Vancouver Island, I should say?
In the middle of the pandemic.
In the middle of the pandemic.
When I think back to that time, that first year I spent teaching in a mask and feeling kind of just not sure about this place. And honestly, it was a great way to start because it just keeps getting better and better in terms of the cool things I can learn about this campus and the ways that I can engage with this place beyond just the woods. The woods have come up. That's because that was the first place I could go, really.
Right.
But now cafes, restaurants, reading spaces, events.
Events with live audiences.
So I've like really fallen in love with this city deliberately and very slowly.
So, I mean, you've been on here in Nanaimo for a relatively short period, mm-hmm. and yet you have endeared yourself, and you are the poet laureate of the city. Yeah. And so I don't think I've had a chance to say congratulations.
Oh, thanks
for that. And what does that mean? What does the poet laureate do?
The way that I posed the poet laureate position mm-hmm. Was that I really see the place of art in this community as being one, like, about considering our neighbors and about having experiences that are maybe befuddling or bewildering or wonderful or joyful together in relation to words on the page, words like spoken in community spaces. Mm-hmm. So that was the one piece. But I also see my role as kind of being like someone who welcomes other poets from afar into this space.
Okay.
So into this community, and to kind of enrich the life of the arts by, being the one who welcomes others in. Mm-hmm. And so those are kind of the two pieces that I'm really curious about. And so it was the main proposal that I had. And part of it actually like came out of COVID. Oh. It came out of like thinking about the isolation from that time mm-hmm. and the way that really damaged reading spaces across yeah. Canada, really. And so just considering like, hey, how could I contribute as a community member, as a neighbor, and as a friend, right?
Yeah.
Poets are launching new work, how can we make spaces for that celebration? Mm-hmm. And also, how can we make poetry not more accessible per se, but more visible by also having like workshops or like reflective components that maybe precede a specific writer coming, so that people have encountered their work before they arrive in the community. Mm-hmm. So that's also like an initiative that I'm just starting to get going. And there'll be a reading series that continues hopefully for 2 years and beyond. So, and that I love that piece.
Yeah. Oh, excellent. I'm glad to hear. I think sometimes people have the impression that, I mean, my impression of writers in general, right, is that sometimes people who are writing are very solitary. They're not, you know, mm-hmm. I do a lot of my writing by myself, sadly.
I do, yeah. I'm not a cafe writer or anything like
no,
that.
No, really, it's just, you know, it's just you and the work. And it's great to hear that it's a role that is so kind of community facing.
Hi, this is Neil Serkin from the English department at VIU. You are listening to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities on CHLY 101.7 FM, Nanaimo. Yeah, my first book came out in 2018, and I organized myself a little tour and got to just ask a bunch of my heroes to read with me across Canada. And the first couple, like I remember the first one was at Massey Books, and I was so scared that I had a hard time listening. And luckily, it just kind of like locked in around like the third reader or so. I got to be like, oh, the best part of the reading is the listening. Like it's like it's that kind of participation, and yeah. getting to show my own work is not secondary, but it's supplementary in some ways to me. And so that's the piece that I really wanted to add into the laureateship, was just to really give people spaces to listen and contribute when they're ready, that mm-hmm. kind of interplay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that means we can look forward to all kinds of exciting yeah. events.
There are some good ones in the works. Yay! Yeah, there really are.
Oh, that's
and
that's
there'll be
exciting.
Some prompts popping up around town, just like little poetry pause moments for people to consider. They won't be called poetry pause, but they will pause traffic or whatever. Yeah.
And so with keep your eye out for those.
Yeah, yeah. yeah, even better. Yes. there are these like little botanical signs around Nanaimo in gardens that I find very aesthetically beautiful. They're about the size of a tarot card. I don't know how many people that would help to visualize. A little bigger than a playing card.
Yeah.
And they're on these funny little blue posts that are like just a fantastic design. And so I was like, what if we put some prompts on those? What if people bumped into those near the gardens or near kind of like some spaces that are important to this community?
Oh, that's cool.
And that ones that disrupted maybe the history or the context of this place, or ones that just invited you to kind of just get into the sensorium of the body and just kind of play around with that moment of encounter in language. So again, invitations to kind of just build your own stuff, not with like a publishable goal in mind, but just like with the reflective quality of poetry as a superpower. And I think mm-hmm. we can use it more.
Yeah. Well, it'd be really neat to see those types of, I mean, as a historian.
Yeah.
The history ones are the ones that particularly interest me, right?
Sweet.
That there are some places in Nanaimo where it would be really neat to have people kind of interrogate the positioning of a particular kind of historical edifice, like the Bastion, or you know, like, and to think, or the Squamish canoe is another one of my favorites. You know, there's a lot of kind of, as I tell some of my students, there's a lot of kind of quirky heritage in Nanaimo that it's like our colonial past is there, but it's also kind of, it's like a palimpsest. It's kind of been written over and over. How is writing for you different in Nanaimo than it was not on the island? Do you think the place influences your practice?
Yeah, big time, but usually in retrospect.
Okay.
So like when I was living in Toronto, I was writing about Vancouver.
Ah.
When I was living in Vancouver, I was writing about the year I lived in Taipei.
Right.
Like, and when I finally got to Calgary to do my PhD, I wrote about Toronto mostly.
Right.
Although the PhD was long enough that I started writing about the early times in Calgary. And I also, like, I make stuff up when I'm working as well, or kind of superimpose different events on each other. So I don't really feel any need to situate everything in the place that it actually occurred, as long as I can kind of like transplant things in with some sort of feasibility. So there are a lot, the palimpsest, I guess, comes back, but it's like this, there's a lot of overlap or imbrication of place in my work, with very specific spots that you should be able to spot or feel in the body. So, Nanaimo-wise, I'm trying not to be like a nature poet while I'm here, but it's like, it feels really crucial to be a poet of the environment right now. Like, and so thinking about these brinks or crises is obviously is very central to my work. As it is in many poets' work right now. So being here and noticing the ecological shifts, even across the years that I've been here, is like, fuel for the work in some ways. But I have a, like, I have a Piper's Lagoon poem, you know. So I feel like I have an arbutus that sneaks in sometimes, you know, or things like that.
It's
so
hard to keep arbutus,
those bits of place.
They're just so beautiful.
And Calgary, I tried really hard not to. I grew up in the Okanagan, so my early work that I found, like the first times where my poems started to, you know, get published, and they were maybe a little snarky about a particular kind of like masculinity, a particular kind of tourism from the Okanagan that I saw. There was a specific kind of conservative culture there that I was actually not that aware of till I left. But it gets into you, you know. So I tried actually not to see Calgary that way, or to really just like attack this place with irony. And Nanaimo, I'm also trying to do the same. That's a different, that it's a difference between like calling out injustice or rejecting a particular behavior. But yeah, my first book, especially, or my first chapbook, was kind of like a little sly or a little snider than I just feel I can be now as a parent specifically. So yeah, so that's kind of, the Nanaimo poems feel that way just because that's the nexus of my life and the way I want to be porous.
How old is Eddie?
Eddie's 5.
Okay.
So,
and does he like poetry?
Yeah, he really does. He will. Actually, I received some beautiful notebooks as a gift last year. If Eddie ever hears this, he will be offended that I've shared this with you. But he wrote poems in them. He's clearly like a spontaneous writer. He's the kind of writer that, were he in my creative writing course, I would ask him to slow down a little bit. But he filled all of them.
He filled all
with,
the notebooks.
With hasty markings in about 15 or 20 minutes. Like, just incredible production line of destroying these notebooks, and but saying they were poetry. So we have kept them. They're fabulous. They also were notebooks I was looking forward to writing in. And savoring. I go really slowly through notebooks. So it was a harsh thing to watch happen, but also kind of remarkable.
It's humbling.
And I love art that is like really hasty, but then presented with like gravity. And that's how these notebooks feel. And that was his first utterance of being like, I'm making poems. And because there is so much poetry in our house, there are so many books lying around all the time. Sometimes I am kind of reclusively hiding out in a room where I have a door and I'm trying to think through something. It's definitely something he's noticing and that he talks about, he cares about.
Which kind of speaks also to the practicality of being a being a scholar of any kind and having small children around. Do you find that it's, parenting has changed like the way that you practice?
I'm slower. That's the main thing. The like this manuscript in process or progress that's kind of, I've now, it's sent out. It's kind of, so I'm in that waiting zone. It's also a time to like think back and be like, oh, like when's the last time I didn't think about writing? You know?
Yeah.
So it's just kind of like this gap, but it was a much slower process. Mm-hmm. Not for the worst. Like I think it's just those moments where I really got to sink in were fewer and but they were really savory when they happened.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes, yeah, hard one. I would say hard one is the, but it's also hard to say, like I've never had an experience of not beginning parenting in a pandemic. Like Eddie was 9 months old when we went into lockdown in Calgary, mm-hmm. which lasted pretty much the whole time until I came to VIU. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And I had one book launch in December on December 10th in Vancouver mm-hmm. for my second book. And then someone at the launch was like, hey, have you heard of this thing called like Omicron? And then we locked down like the next day again, right?
Yes.
So like popping up for a moment. So I don't know if that's also why this next book took so long. It's a mixture of parenting and fear.
Yes.
So the two of them together were restrictive in terms of creation.
Parallel and hope. I mean, we always try to keep the fear out of the parenting.
Yeah.
It's a challenge, but
exactly. That know? Too.
Particularly in a pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The kind of constant assault of what's coming next and how are we going to deal with it?
I also was talking to a friend just yesterday about when the conversation about like the climate crisis will really be had with Eddie, like on frank terms.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've heard of The Octonauts. It's like a Netflix cartoon, you know, Octonauts.
I am familiar with The Octonauts.
Yeah, like The Octonauts will talk about like glaciers melting and things like that. And occasionally Eddie would get bewildered and grieve something after watching, just being like, wait, what are they saying? Is that real?
Right,
and it's because they also have spaceships. So is that real or not? Like, what's the real part?
Aren't they octopi?
Yeah, there's right? Like, there's like a polar bear captain and like all those things, right? So like those moments of being like, wait, what's real and what's not here?
Yeah.
And is there a crisis in the real world or not?
Mm-hmm.
Were conversations that we kind of so far have coaxed around. I actually worked on a poem about this for a while, about this idea of sustaining a sense of optimism in him for a little longer, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps that's we should be judged for that, but I don't want to be too frank too quickly about it. Those conversations are still ongoing, and mm-hmm. they're definitely something I'm thinking about in my work a lot. Yeah.
When you think about it, which is something I do, I'm a historian of childhood. When you think about it, so many things in a child's life are things that their parents, they sustain their belief in them because they want to perpetuate that sense mm-hmm. of hope, mm-hmm. right? Like, mm-hmm. like Santa Claus.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Like there's a sense of nostalgia where I don't think this necessarily applies to the climate crisis as much, but there are lots of opportunities as parents to like relive our own childhoods through the wonder of our children.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the, you know, whether that's wonder at the beauty of nature or, you know, or Santa Claus or Christmas or things like that. It's, yeah, I think we're kind of hardwired to protect them, to want to protect them from hard things. But also there's this, you know, desire to like recreate that epic scavenger hunt that you had so much fun doing when you were 10, or, you know, we want to experience it through their eyes again in some ways. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't want to curtail his wonder at this time, for sure.
Yeah.
And my son's like an animal guy. He like really loves creatures. And I like that. When I was a child, I really liked collecting creatures. Like I liked terrariums. I liked arranging them. I liked those things.
Right.
And Eddie is more into just like observing and marveling at them. I'm down with that. That's cool. I think it's a good
for a walk and look at
a good lineage shift. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, to not have that feel threatened, I think, yet, and to really build that love up first is paramount to me.
You've been listening to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities. Thanks to Neil Serkin for joining us today. Technical production by Robin Davies. Music by Greg Bush. The Colloquium series will be back in March with Paul Watkins presenting Saunan Kinnean, Remixing the Remix. For more information, visit our website by going to ah.viu.ca and clicking Colloquium Series. I'm Catherine Rollweigen. Thanks for listening.